Are you in a rut?
Stressed by the demands of your personal, professional, and social lives? Join lifestyle guru Pauline Brown right now for Tastemakers.
That's really where people can really make the celebrated individual the centerpiece.
She invites her friends to share tips of the trade and new ideas for bringing out the best in you.
My real passion is style, and not just style, but design, beauty, all things aesthetic.
Turn the mundane into the memorable with Pauline Brown on Tastemakers.
Welcome to Tastemakers. This is Pauline Brown. I am so excited for today's show. I have two people who inspire me and have for some time. I've had each of them on the show before, never together, and ironically enough, they are longtime friends. So number one, I have here Colin Cowie, who you probably have heard his name. He's a big celebrity in his own right, but as importantly, he has worked with almost every celebrity I can name, from Oprah Winfrey to Jerry Seinfeld, in the area of lifestyle entertaining. He's a master of everything from wedding receptions to holiday parties, you name it. Such a great eye for detail. I say he's the Steven Spielberg of events. So welcome back to the studio.
Thanks, Pauline. Delighted to be with you. Happy holidays.
And I also have Georgette Farkas, who has exquisite taste. She has been a restaurateur for her entire career. She worked for the first several chapters for a very famous French chef based here in New York named Daniel Boulud. He has a number of restaurants, including the very famous Daniel, where she was a manager. And then some years ago, I want to say about 5-6 years ago, maybe even seven, she opened her own restaurant here in New York. It's called Georgette. It is one of my favorite. It's well known for its poulet rôti. Okay, see,
or just simply roast chicken in any language. It's something that delights and pleases.
It's so good.
It's the best roast chicken
it's
in
so
New York
good.
City.
And when either Pauline or Colin walk in the door, I feel like something must be going right. I've done something right.
Well, you have done something right, and one of the reasons I wanted you to join this conversation is it isn't just the chicken that you do right. You have many other things on the menu, but it's the decor, it's the lighting, it's this home-style approach and exquisite service. So I really wanted to spend this conversation talking about advice that each of you have as others are gearing up to celebrate the holidays. And, you know, big ideas, small ideas, just ways to do it tastefully, originally, joyfully. So thank you. Yeah. Thank you for coming. Colin, for the 1% of the population out there who are not familiar with you, let's just talk about your career through this sort of wild and crazy space that you're in, that you've kind of pioneered. You didn't start as a wedding planner, which is kind of what you're best known for.
No, I started studying pharmacy.
Far from it, then.
And then I was in the military, and I was a senior medic in the military, which was an incredible experience. I delivered 13 babies in the operational area.
So wow!
Add that to my skill set. Uh-huh. And then I came to the U.S. in 1985. I didn't believe in the political system in South Africa at the time. I didn't think there was a future there. Mm-hmm. And I arrived here with $400, an omnipresent suntan, one well-cut suit, and big dreams. And it's been an amazing journey.
And you arrived in L.A.?
Los Angeles.
Yeah. And so how do you go from aspirations of pharmacy work to actually this whole other space that you're in? What was the turning point?
It's all mixing. It's just different ingredients.
Right. It's all chemistry.
It's a different formula.
It's
completely.
Always the ingredients.
Absolutely. I believe I have a unique sense of style, and mm-hmm. I was a little ahead of the curve, and there was nobody doing what I was doing, certainly not doing it on the scale that I ended up doing it. But I started off with a small catering company, and then I had these clients like Bruce Willis and Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Barbra Streisand. And I mean, I was this like simple boy from South Africa who all of a sudden, and the interesting thing was California cuisine at the time was take a piece of chicken, marinate it overnight, beat the hell out of it, put it on a bed or something and sprinkle something on top of it, right?
So
and you were done. It was so overproduced, and it was just before the real California cuisine came out. And I'd just come back from Europe, and I was doing branzino and arugula and angel hair pasta with tomato sauce, and I had a very European sense of style, and it picked up very, very quickly. And I started with a small catering company, and then the next minute, 2 years later, three years later, I did Hugh Hefner's wedding. And that kind of got me labeled as Mr. Wedding. Then I started writing my first book. Started around about that time. I did a television show for 5 years. I did two different seasons, a series. And then the morning show, CBS, was 8 years. Eight years on NBC in the morning.
And now just a few years later, you are working on your 11th book.
I'm working on my 11th book, and this is a business book. And it's I've traveled 15 million miles around the world and visited almost 100 countries in pursuit of finding the very best for my clients, and having a very inquisitive and a curious nature. And I've just noticed wherever you look, everything is oversaturated. And you're seeing now with what's happening online, it's even easier, and there's just more choice out there than ever. So how do you fathom your way?
How do you cut through the clutter and get to the real quality?
I always say great style comes from ruthless editing. It's about knowing what 90% to get rid of and find 10% you can tell a smart story with. So the new book is called Above and Beyond, and it's really the art of how do we create proactive customer service.
Interesting. So as you know, I wrote a book that just came out, Aesthetic Intelligence. In the second part of the book, I talk about the fundamental steps of developing taste. And the fourth, which is really You've Arrived, is all about editing and curation. It's exactly where you start, because you came to this world with more advantages.
When in doubt, throw it out.
Tell that to all the hoarders in my life.
I think that goes for makeup and jewelry. When you're getting dressed in the morning, the makeup and the jewelry. When in doubt, leave it out.
But simplicity. I have to tell you, one of the beauties of coming to your restaurant is not only is the food delicious and the ambiance very elegant, and you always have a great group of people, but Georgette makes you feel like you're the only person in the room.
Yes.
And she does it in 4-inch heels.
Yes.
They used to say about Ginger Rogers, she did everything Fred Astaire did, only in 4-inch heels and backwards.
Exactly. Right.
So, no, I think that's there. I so strongly believe, and I try to impart this to my team, that in New York City especially, and as you've said, around the world, in New York City tonight, there are thousands of other restaurants my guests could go to. Why should they come to our place? I think I've assured the food is going to be impeccable and that their banquet is going to be comfortable. But that extra touch, how do you make them feel welcome, that they have come to a place that is awaiting them, that is expecting them, and cannot wait to have them come in the door? And I think that really makes a huge difference.
But you
difference.
See, what you've just said is you've created the emotional connection.
That's it.
And if you don't create an emotional connection today, someone will just shop on and go to the next product. And that's probably one of the big parts of my new book, is that without emotional connection, you're just a product.
Yes.
And that's why you do it so well.
And that's why your clients, even though not many people need more than one wedding, some need many, of course, but your clients, I know for a fact, come back to you again and again for so many different family and business celebrations, because of course, they trust you, but it even goes beyond trust. It's something that's parallel to trust, is that emotional connection.
So let me ask you, Georgette, similar to Colin, you didn't start by saying, I'm going to open a restaurant.
Actually,
You did?
Did. I mean, so not to contradict.
Let me actually just, well, okay, on paper.
The only other thing I ever wanted to do was to be a ballerina, so now I just dance around the dining room.
Okay.
On paper, I'll explain.
In 4-inch heels.
Yes. My first job as a cook in a professional kitchen was at age 15. I started spending all of my summer holidays working as a cook, not just as a summer job, but I knew that I wanted to be in restaurants. I was absolutely fascinated with food and dedicated to food. I know I didn't want to be a chef, but I really felt it. One, I did love cooking, and I felt that that most important road into the restaurant world was through cooking. There are a lot of restaurant owners or restaurateurs who aren't chefs, but to me that was important, and it was also something I loved. I determined from a very early age, if I tell you how young, you won't believe me, that I was going to go to Swiss Hotel School, because I thought that's how it's done. And I spent a lot of my childhood in Europe, and I decided that dedication to old world service and quality and discretion was the way that felt right to me. That's what I would do. So from a very early age, it had to do with people I knew as a child, I was going to go to Swiss Hotel School if I couldn't make it as a ballerina, which it wasn't going to happen.
Definitely not if you kept working in the kitchen.
No, no.
The two don't go together.
No, they don't. But now I have lots of ballerinas who come to my restaurant. It makes me so happy. But in any event, so I did that. I did, throughout, you know, my teens and my early 20s, I did go to university first, and I studied European history.
And not just any university. I mean, you went to Harvard.
I went to Harvard,
and I studied. Most people don't go to Harvard thinking that they're going to, you know, be restaurateurs.
I wrote my...
She's the first person here from Harvard that didn't tell you in the first 5 minutes that you went to Harvard.
No, it's not important.
That's called the H-bomb.
I wrote my thesis on the historical development of restaurants in Paris, or where to eat after the revolution. So I was on a track from early on, but actually a real an important turning point. I did take a year off from Harvard to go and work as a cook for Daniel Boulud, and it was the first time I worked for him. It was sort of a miracle that he let me into his kitchen because I wasn't as qualified as his other cooks, but somehow actually I had come from doing an apprenticeship with a great restaurant in France with chef who had been his mentor, and that sort of, you know, help things along. But in any event, that's where it started, and it also helped me to confirm in my own mind that after university I would go to hotel management school in Switzerland, which I did. I did go back and finish college first and then went off to hotel school, et cetera. And that's a 4-year stint of every year, 6 months in school and 6 months in apprenticeship, which is wonderful because in those 4 years you really get your hands dirty and have incredible experiences that were really foundational to the later stages in my career. So I stayed in Europe for many years after that. But when I came back to New York, Daniel called me and said, I need someone who does what you do. And he didn't even say what the job was because he's so smart, or we joke about it still. If he had said what it actually was,
he would never have taken
I would never have taken it, or he didn't know what it was. But I think he was just very clever. And it ended up being, I mean, of course, I thought either he'll put me in the kitchen or the front of the house, because at this point I can do, you know, I can go either in either direction. It ended up being sort of a catch-all and eventually a marketing and communications job. And I would have said to him, chef, no, I don't know anything about that. I don't do that. But I think he saw beyond that and thought that that's what I should do.
Now, the business is not known for being kind toward women, not in the kitchen and not really on the management side either.
I'm going to disagree.
Okay, disagree. Tell me that it is.
Maybe I have had a unique experience. I don't know. As I said, my first jobs in the kitchen were from age 15. And at that stage, was I the only woman or girl then in the kitchen? Yes. But the cooks I worked with were so decent and respectful of me. Almost 20 years with Daniel Boulud, I had only just the most decent and respectful experiences. The thing is, the ones you read about in the newspaper are the salacious things because that's what sells newspapers. And I'm not saying those things didn't happen. Of course they did. But it's so important to know that the restaurant community is full of really decent, kind, hardworking, generous people who are not all thugs.
Well, there's another issue that comes up, not having to do with issues of harassment or even discrimination, but the intensity, especially
it's
for women our age, you know, I mean...
If you go into the restaurant world, you have made a choice to work every night, every weekend, and every holiday. Yes, there are some part-time positions, and yes, you can occasionally get off a Saturday night because you're getting married, But if you're going to be in the restaurant business and if you're going to be in it to win it, you're going to work nights, weekends, and holidays, and that's a choice. Restaurants are dying to have smart, capable women come to work for them. Come apply for the jobs. Restaurant companies are dying to have great women in their businesses.
True for events as well, Colin?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So we have to take a break, but when we're back, I actually want to probe with both of you on what it takes to be successful, as you both are, in your respective fields. What are the qualities you look for in that next generation? So stay with us. You're listening to Tastemakers. We'll be right back.
More with Pauline Brown on Tastemakers on SiriusXM Stars.
Welcome back to Tastemakers. This is Pauline Brown. I'm here today with Colin Cowie, the extraordinary event planner who, among many other events, is planning his own wedding. Also, Georgette Farkas, who is a very talented restaurateur with her own place called Georgette's here in New York. Before we went to the break, we were talking about what it takes to succeed, or we started to talk certainly about what you each had to do to succeed in your respective businesses. As you look for people, and you're both always looking for people, what are some of the most important qualities in who you hire for, you know, whether it's the creative functions or more the operational ones? What would you say, Colin?
I think passion for me is a very, very important one. Obviously, we're taking for granted that they're aptly qualified for the job. Mm-hmm. I think passion is an important one for me because it's, I think, to do what we do, you need to have a very rich corporate culture within the company, and you need passionate people for the type of work that we do. I like people that are early there to start, mm-hmm. late at the end of the day, mm-hmm. That have respect for one another. We have a great community in our office, mm-hmm. and we celebrate one another, and there's a lot of respect for everyone. And I could not be what I am without the team of people that I have.
Mm. Would you add anything to that?
I would just have to second that building your team, I think it's the most challenging part and the most important part, and it's still something that every day I feel I could do a better job at. This may be similar in your world. I think another quality, especially in the front of house, but not only in the front of house, is to look for people who actually take pleasure in pleasing.
Yes.
People who like to make people happy, because of course people are work in your business to earn a living. Of course they do, but people who actually enjoy making people happy will make the difference.
There's so many people who are cast in the wrong jobs, and I think particularly anyone who's customer facing, it's a certain skill set that you want. You want a certain sense of elegance. You want them to be able to present themselves in a certain way. A lot of those things, you can certainly guide people and teach them, but inherently you need to have
character.
That from within you. You
Those
have
are
to
the
have
things
that within you.
I think you cannot train for character and decency. So those are the things you, in theory, need to hire for. Skill sets, to a degree, you can teach. I'm not saying it's easy.
Correct.
But
I go on one further and saying, we don't train people who are customer facing. People who are customer facing, and then you train dogs, and you train people in the military, right? It's very tactical. And I think you educate people in customer facing situations, give them a skill set and a set of tools to work with. So combined with their common sense and intelligence, 9 times out of 10, they'll make the right choice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some of what you're talking about also is empathy. The fact that you're not just there to do a job, that you're there to elevate the experience for somebody else,
and to be responsible.
You know,
if something is because in our business anything can go wrong at any time for 1,000 different reasons.
The big tip off that you may have the wrong person, not to hate to be negative, is someone who is constantly blaming others for something that goes wrong. If you don't take things can go wrong, and they do, they will, they absolutely will. But no matter what your job is, whether you're a dishwasher or a busser, a cook, a server, and everywhere along the way, if you're not, if the individual employee isn't willing to take responsibility and then help fix the problem, then you don't have the right person.
So Colin, I've mentioned a few times you are about to get married. You've been working on this wedding of your own for 14 months. Big day is in February, and it's a destination wedding, so the planning is all the more intensive around that. It isn't just a sort of one evening in the year. How would you compare the experience of doing this for yourself? You are the client.
I'm a dream client. I make decisions like that.
That is true. And you know the budget and there's no negotiating.
Exactly.
But also, did you apply a different standard? I mean, you part of your job when you're working with all these people, particularly the big personalities, is that you got to read their mind sometimes. They don't even articulate what they want. They just want it to be just so.
Yes.
So I would think on that front, this is so much easier.
It just came to me so easily.
But the ideas, when you were describing for me some of the ideas that are going into this wedding, this is totally unorthodox.
Oh, it's a production. But everything I do is a production.
Uh-huh.
You always want to appeal to what you smell, touch, taste, see, and hear.
Yeah.
And it's different morning, noon, and night. And you do different things, spring, summer, winter, fall. So it's always enhancing and manipulating all those small nuances that people can understand why they're having such a good time.
So how do you meld the ideation and coming up with so many creative ideas with just the operational perfection that is also
Well, I think you have to dream first. It costs nothing to dream. So dream big and come up with that big picture, because that'll help you shape every creative decision that you need to make. And then we get into, we create the nuts and the bolts, we create the outline for it, and then I really look for all the small nuances, the things that are really going to get under people's skin and say, oh my God, I can't believe they did this.
So that's the final. So you mentioned to me you have mood boards. And I talk in my book a little bit about the power of mood boards, not just for creative directors.
For dreaming.
Anyone. So tell me how you use mood boards.
I usually use a mood board to articulate a thought that I have with the rest of my team. So I sit with my creative team and we'll come up with mood board for every single event. There's a general mood board and there's a mood board for this, for pre-ceremony. There's a mood board for cocktails, there's a mood board for the ceremony, there's a mood board for dinner, there's a mood board for dancing, there's a mood board for the nightclub.
Do you use Pinterest?
I don't. I used to use a long time ago.
But you actually like the physical. You like to put cloth and you like to put...
That comes next. So we did all that first, and then I flew back to South Africa to go and do all the physical, the tastings and the wine pairings and making sure that the flowers were the right... look and feel, and the linens and the fabrics, and I've used this as a way to write a very interesting narrative for the wedding. And I'm not doing anything that goes according to textbook. I've looked at everything as an opportunity to be an expression of our statement of style, who we are.
And are you seeing in general, because you do a lot of weddings, you and your team, that others are less conventional in this? You know, in this in the 20th century, 21st century versus when you started 20, 30 years ago?
Yes, I think, you know, there was more, it was more formulaic, it was more traditional. And I think today there's more intercultural marriages, there's more interracial marriages, things that change completely, there's a blending of different cultures. And I think as long as you are doing something tastefully, I always encourage to do something different and do something unique. I mean, this is not just another party. It's your opportunity to make your joint statement of style.
Yeah.
You know, you were two separate people before, but who are you today? And what do you stand for? And what do you represent? And I think it goes down to the choice of every single ingredient and the energy in the room. And, you know, that's the stuff that I really love, because once you have all these ingredients, you have to play, get to play maestro with them.
Right, right. And you certainly are a conductor, a very skilled one. So Georgette, speaking of changing, so I mentioned before the 7 or so years that your restaurant has been open here in New York. You've been known for this very particular sort of Provençal style of roast chicken, which is scrumptious. How do you think about adapting the menu such that the people who come can be interested in coming that much more often?
Find something new, of course. Well, this is something Colin touched on. It goes without saying, this is just built into my culinary DNA, that change comes by definition with every season. So there are some just core items on the menu. We will always have a roast chicken on the menu. But what is the fun and creative part is everything around that that evolves with every season. So all of the appetizers, all of the side dishes, the desserts, the cocktails as well, all of those change with the season. So, you know, we get even more Provençal in the summertime when you think more towards Mediterranean, south of France with the warm weather. But the change comes in winter. Like right now, a chestnut soup with black truffle. A gratin, you know, you wouldn't eat a gratin in the summertime, but in the winter, you know, you can
You can hard it a whole lot easier in the winter, too.
That's true.
But in the wintertime, we can, you know, you crave something a little bit more warm and a little bit of richness,
hearty,
a little more comforting. Exactly. But at the same time, what I go more and what I always crave are, you could, although we're known for our roast chicken, a vegetarian could have a feast in our restaurant. For example, right now, a whole roasted cauliflower, Romanesco cauliflower, the beautiful bright green. So the visual, right away, you're just delighted with the presentation. It's first blanched and then roasted and dressed with lemon and cumin and toasted pistachio. So that's a beautiful meal right there, whether you have it as your dinner or as a side dish. I mentioned starting with a creamy, velvety, smooth chestnut soup. And then now in December come the Perigord black truffles. So a roast chicken with black truffle under the skin and a black truffle jus, that is for me the heart and soul of winter. And it's sort of defines our restaurant. We're this intersection of both absolute simplicity and luxury, but luxury that's not hidden under layers. It's just right there, the the essence of the ingredient. So the simple roast chicken roasted with black truffle under the skin and a black truffle jus, that's, to me, that's perfection, and it's winter cooking.
And I love it so simple.
It seems simple. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to recreate
it that
well.
Mr. Balanchine always said this: the hardest thing is what looked simplest, walking across the stage.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So another question, and I'm thinking, if I were to open a restaurant tomorrow, you do not want to go if she ever does that.
I mean, just watch what you wish for.
But so you start with this raw space, and I'm sure in your mind you had a few inspirations.
Oh, I had a very clear picture of
you
what
knew.
It...
Oh, because you even used tile from your mom, from like her trips to Morocco.
I have a very particular aesthetic. It's very old world and it's very traditional. I don't think I could design anyone else's restaurant, but for my restaurant, I really knew exactly what I want. I wanted it to feel comfortable and warm and inviting. And you would sort of feel that when you walked in, that it would look as though it had always been there, but maybe you didn't know that. I chose this space that has these beautiful soaring high ceilings, so right away it doesn't feel so New York. It actually feels quite old world. It feels as though you
could be Vienna.
It could be. And then I built things into it that feel as though they might have always been there. They're not. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful parquet floors, and I thought no one is ever going to notice these beautiful parquet floors, but I do. But you know what? People notice them all the time. There are beautiful moldings that were handmade for the space, and they're quite huge. They're much too big, but because we've got these, 14-foot ceilings, it fills the space. Little things like that. Those
and all the porcelains and the tile
work. Yes,
the
tiles.
Fabulous.
I had dreamt of having these Portuguese azulejos just because they're beautiful, and I was actually importing them from Lisbon in preparation to open the restaurant, and I showed my mother a photo of the tiles I was buying, and I said, Mom, don't worry, it's in the budget. They're not 18th-century tiles, but they're hand-painted. They're lovely. She said, no, you can't don't get them. And she's a bit of a joker, so I was wondering, Mom, don't worry. She said, no, I have a warehouse full of Portuguese tiles. And only my mother could say that, and you would know that it was true. So it turned out that my father had, he traveled all the time for business and would buy things for himself and just send them home to a warehouse. And she had saved these caseloads of Portuguese tiles that he bought. And they make this incredible statement in the restaurant. They fill a whole wall. They're beautiful. They make it feel like something from another place and time. They're exquisite.
Well, you picked a good mom in addition to a good restaurant location.
Yeah, lucky me.
So let's talk about the holidays, because they are upon us, and I would guess that there's more celebrating that goes on now than any other time in the year. And by now, I mean in the next 10 days. so what are some of the ideas that each of you are seeing or are most excited about 2019 Christmas
New Year's? I went to three parties last night.
Oh, my. Oh, tell. Do you tell.
And I'm going to one tonight, and I saw Daniel at a party last night. I think this is not the time to do sit-down dinners. We do that before and after. This is a great try to reciprocate if you haven't entertained a long time, to bring a group of people together. And it's all about cocktail parties, I think, and setting up food stations so people can help themselves and have an abundance. The interesting thing about the type of food that we'd like to eat at this type of the year doesn't mean that you need to be slave to the kitchen or chained to the stove. You can literally buy everything. You can buy fabulous gourmet pâtés and wonderful dried meats and salamis, and you can buy chilled, beautiful poached shrimp and lobster tails, or frying some Joe's stone crabs, and you can do really fun things. Get a whole side of smoked salmon. You can... It's about more being resourceful and savvy than I think having to feel that you have to cook it all yourself.
Absolutely.
And particularly in a city like New York, the best cheeses. You can go to Citarella. You can go all over the vinegar factory. You can find such great produce that you take home and present it very beautifully. So come up with a great cocktail of the day, make one great cocktail.
So just one.
I'm a big believer in that one exquisite cocktail that obviously has to be delicious and balanced, but that has a beautiful visual impact that delights the eye.
Vintage old coupe champagne glasses.
So each a cocktail that you've had or are envisioning having that really excites you for this time of year.
Yes.
What would get your favorite cocktail?
Something with bourbon, burnt orange, something along those lines, a Manhattan.
Okay.
I'm going to pick up on the orange theme because winter is the season of citrus fruit, so we're always inspired by the season. I have a cocktail that I've put on the menu, L'Orange Fumée, and it's as the smoky orange because it's got a bit of mezcal and Grand Marnier. So the mezcal gives it, and it's an unexpected combination. My friends at Grand Marnier said, do you mind if I put Grand Marnier mixed with mezcal? And they were delighted. So the mezcal gives that slightly smoky, spicy touch. And I actually use fresh orange juice, which isn't normally put in this sort of cocktail. So it's a unique combination, and it's kind of orange to the power of orange between the fresh juice and the Grand Marnier and fresh orange garnish.
I just love the color. I love that deep orange. This time of year makes me feel warm.
I love mixing all alcohol with orange. I like to have, if I drink vodka, I drink vodka with a slice of orange. If I drink tequila, I drink tequila with a slice of orange.
So what about, let's talk decor. So I was at a cocktail party this week, and it was classic Christmas. They had all that sort of tinsel, which I'm not a fan, and there was a lot of, it was fake greenery. You know, sort of to approximate. And it's practical because you don't get, you know, whether it's the pines on the ground or, you know, it's easier in general for cleanup. But it felt faux. It felt faux.
I think that if you're living in a tropical climate, I could understand using faux holiday greens. But here where we live, and I mean, there's on every street corner, you can find greens, you can find a Christmas tree, you can go to the market, you find it everywhere and readily available.
Are you guys fans of poinsettia?
Yes, I like, but you know, if I'm going to do them, I like to get 100 of them.
I love the
white ones. I think they're really beautiful. Mm.
I love magnolia wreaths and magnolia branches. Yes. There's just something that feels almost Dickensian and old.
And very wintry with a gorgeous, beautiful silk ribbon. Mm. Yeah.
How do you feel, and I live outside the city, about Christmas lights?
I'm not big on colored lights.
You
know, I don't mind
lots of tiny little white ones.
I don't mind if it's all white. I love that. Or all gold. I love that. Or all red. But the moment the colors start to go from one color to the next, I mean, it starts to make Christmas a little kitsch.
Yeah.
And it's actually interesting because it's the one time of the year where we do get licensed to be kitsch. Because everything that sparkles.
But no reindeers on the lawn.
I think you touched on something that is probably always one of the best design ideas. Lots of one thing is beautiful and makes a statement and is impactful, and it will generally avoid the kitsch if you avoid mixing too
going
many
back to your mood
colors.
Board I always believe that you come up with a theme for the holiday. You know, pick a color, pick a shape, pick a genre and run with that. You know, I've done so many amazing Christmas trees. I mean, for the white Christmas, and then the day of my party, I'll get 3 dozen roses and I put them into test tubes and I cover the tree with fresh roses.
Oh,
I put them into the wreath. And I always like to start whatever decoration I have on the front door, it's the same thing that you'll see on the mantelpiece, it's the same thing on the tree, the same thing on the gift wrapping.
You stay on message.
So there's one thread of style from the beginning that weaves its way all through everything, right down to the trays that you serve your food on. Because we're storytellers. And we tell the stories through the senses of what you smell, touch, taste, and this time we just put a holiday spin on it.
When I'm in the city, it's harder to do, although I do go out on my terrace and do it. In my years spent out in the countryside, what I would do any time to decorate is I would just go to the garden.
Nice.
I would cut branches from trees and flowers, staying within one theme. And it just goes to show you don't even actually need to. That's a unique thing to be in the countryside and do that. But if you can, it brings the outside in and you stay with one theme. And it's just beautiful that it comes from your own garden. It's not about what you bought at the store. It's about creating.
So true. I was, for Thanksgiving, I was on an island in the Bahamas. And there was no flower store or anything.
We took everything with us.
I went outside and I picked and I cut and everything with this gorgeous tropical Thanksgiving.
There's so many at your
and everything came from the garden.
Right, you just don't think about what you can buy at the store. Think about what is right at your doorstep.
Right. Well, I like grass, actually. I've seen that on tables looking elegant. Probably not as elegant as what you could do, Colin, with a piece of grass, with one blade of grass. Music.
For the holidays.
Okay.
I think that if you're going to listen to Christmas carols from beginning to end, you'll shoot yourself. Okay? So take your best.
You'll shoot the person who's playing that music.
So I like to take like my current best playlist, and maybe there's 20 songs on there. I'll drop in 5 holiday songs. So every 4th song, I'll throw in a holiday song. And I find it's better, it's more palatable, it's kind of more fun because it's like current with a bit of holiday.
Right, and then when your guests hear that one little interspersed holiday tune, they're delighted as opposed to horrified. It's wonderful.
And for the rotation, for the non-holiday songs, are there particular sounds that you think work really well in these winter months? As you know, you were talking before about flavors and sort of richness of food. Are there certain music that you think feel better this time of year?
You know, music is so important. It depends on the time of day.
Sets the tone.
It's in the morning. Sometimes I like classical music. You know, some evenings I might be more jazzy. Some evenings I like it to be a little sexier and maybe bunch of new remixes. So it depends on the time of the day and who the crowd is. I think music is very, very important. Yeah. And I think there's such great DJs and curators of music that put together great playlists.
Yeah. The best DJs I've ever heard have been at Collins parties.
Oh, you obviously have an ear. I mean, I was at an event, and of course this takes more resources, but there were just two string instrumentalists who were playing. And there's something so rich about live music.
But I like to layer live music on top of a DJ.
Interesting.
So have a DJ playing, have someone on the side playing drums or percussion, or have someone roaming around playing violin, or something.
For New Year's Eve, I always have a live jazz trio. Yeah. They can mix it up and play. And we stay quite traditional jazz. And really, what you were saying before, they intersperse the occasional holiday tune, but it just makes it fun and festive. And people walk in and see these fabulous jazz musicians in their tuxedos, and right away they feel that they're at a special night. Yeah.
So we've talked about holiday, we've talked prior to that a little bit about your wedding. In general, weddings that are happening now, as opposed to the majority that seem to be in May, June, September, warm months, what are some of the different sort of themes that you like, where it sort of stops from being cliche a winter wedding?
The interesting thing is I'm going to the Southern Hemisphere. Because there's nothing fun about being in New York in February.
This is true.
My entire month of February is going to be in South Africa.
Right, which is it's a glorious time of year.
Yeah, and the funny thing is I'm using all dark colors. It's all
you are, interesting.
It's all anthracite, black, dark burgundy.
But it's so bright there. I mean, the sun, the light, the landscape, the seascape. So you can get away with that. I think if you were to do dark in February in New York, that would be like a funeral. No?
I think, we live in such a specialized world today. Mm. You can find 50 shades of black, and 50 shades of gray. And there was a time before when, there were five colors you could rent tablecloths from. Today there's 550. And we're working with so many tables that don't even require cloths, that are wooden surfaces or mirrored surfaces. And, the sky's the limit. If you can dream it, we can make it, or we'll find it somewhere.
Well, this is why you're good at what you do, because you'll find a way.
And I think that a lot of people say, like, what are the trends right now? I don't do trends. Mm-hmm. Because I think trend's got I think trend has got a very short lifespan. If I'm designing a party or an event or a product or something, you are my trend. Your DNA is my trend.
You're something that will be a personal reflection of your taste and style.
Yeah, exactly. I'm your storyteller.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I know that you are breaking a lot of the traditions purposefully for your own wedding. Are you wearing a tux?
I am wearing a tux.
Colin would look good in a paper bag.
This is true.
You're far too kind. I've done interesting things. Like instead of a straight aisle, we're in a vineyard. There's a serpentine aisle that's all planted. Guests are seated in benches. Instead of having all the men and the women standing on one side and on the other side, it's like a living room, and there's two girls here and a guy, and three girls on the left and a guy. Look like Annie Leibovitz is just about to take the picture. Right? And instead of exchanging rings, we're exchanging beautiful bracelets.
Oh, I love that.
It's a love knot that I designed.
I love that.
With a jeweler friend of mine, and he's got a white gold one, and I've got a yellow gold one. And all of our guests are going to hold them and pass them through the congregation and make a wish for them before we actually do that ceremony.
Oh, nice.
And I've done things, there's ones who are passed, who can no longer be us. I've got small little lockets with their images are tied into the bouquets for each person, so the whole family goes down the aisle together.
Oh, nice.
And I'm not doing dancing during the dinner at all. It's a proper, beautiful, fabulous dinner. I'm having the number one classical pianist from Europe is performing at the beginning of the ceremony, of the reception. I'm doing an incredible, fabulous dinner. And then I finish with the three tenors.
Right.
And then we go outside to cut the cake and dance.
Oh, that's fun.
Till midnight. And then I built a nightclub. And we're going to go from midnight until 6:30 in the morning.
And for people who want to come, there's admission at the door. We won't tell them where it is. I have time for one more question. Really, really important for the wedding, important for the holidays, dessert. Okay. First of all, how do you feel about the tiered cakes? And your favorite, so that's a question for you, Colin, and for Georgette, your favorite holiday sweet.
So a dessert that I always do at Georgette for New Year's Eve, it's actually a French wedding dessert, but I do it for New Year's Eve because it's croque-en-bouche, voilà. Yeah. So we make a great big croque-en-bouche, which is actually sort of a tower of cream puffs, filled cream puffs, and we parade it with sparklers, and then we set it on the bar, and we invite all of the guests to get up and partake of it. So even though people are in a restaurant, it makes them feel like they're just at a private party. They're just there among friends, and they all come together and come and take a piece off.
Nice.
So it's you just don't feel like you're in a restaurant. You feel like you're just at a wonderful party. Mm. So the croque-en-bouche, I mean, you can do fun things with the flavor. Personally, I love a hazelnut cream filling, but we do chocolate, hazelnut, vanilla.
So my cake is a three-tier stacked cake, and it's covered with about 1,000 gray tiles.
It's which are made of what? Which are
made
are
of
chocolate?
Icing. No, they're paper thin made out of icing.
Wow.
They're beautiful. And the inside, two tiers are chocolate and one tier is passion fruit.
Whoa. Yeah.
I don't generally love chocolate and fruit together, except I love chocolate and passion fruit. That's it.
Yes.
Wow.
And I like dark chocolate with orange.
Yes. Well, it has to be dark chocolate. That's just...
Yeah, I mean, don't even talk about any other kind of chocolate. So we have to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment for our final segment. You're listening to Tastemakers.
We now return to Tastemakers with Pauline Brown on Sirius XM Stars.
Welcome back to Tastemakers. This is Pauline Brown. I've been talking about holiday entertaining, about wedding planning, about all things celebrational. I'm here with Georgette Farkas, who's a restaurateur here in New York, and the famous Colin Cowie, who, he is everything. I don't know where to begin. I say Steven Spielberg of events. Every detail is covered with him. And one of the things, I mean, Colin, you're working on this book right now. It really is about sort of a guide for business people around touching the consumer in a profound way, in a meaningful way, in a differentiated way. And we've been talking, in the context of entertaining about what makes for a great and memorable experience. And I guess my question for you, because so many people get that wrong in every business and certainly in the entertainment business. So what does a great experience mean to each of you?
First of all, the whole world, the biggest buzzword right now is experience. Mm. It's used left, right, and center. Mm. And I think the one word that qualifies an experience for me is when you can put the word authentic in front of it. Once you put the word authentic in front of a cuisine, or in front of the word experience, it just changes the playing field completely because it gets rid of so many things that are not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And, for me, an experience only really works if we're able to create that emotional connection with you. I think that's why we go about creating experience. And we rely on the senses to help us tell that and to create a great experience. It's what you smell, touch, taste, see, and hear. Mm-hmm. And how do we put those into some sense of harmony? A lot of people ask me today, what does luxury mean to you? Luxury used to come for me in an orange box with a brown saddle stitch ribbon, or maybe a Tiffany box with a white ribbon. I don't think luxury is a product anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We can find those boxes in train stations and airports, and you can buy it online.
Mm-hmm.
It's too easily accessible. So for me, I think luxury and luxury experience today is when what you smell, touch, taste, see, and hear is all in harmony and you want for nothing.
Mm. Mm. I love that.
And it's been created, there's a sense that it's been created for you
specifically. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think customization is something that's very important.
And we're seeing a lot of ability to customize today because I think customize leads to personalization.
We created, why should I? I'm not good at saying I created the restaurant menu that way because I think I know my customers well. Of course, there are always new customers that I'm meeting, which is wonderful. But I wanted them to have a menu where they could say to me at any time, well, can I substitute that with that? And can I mix that? And can I have that on the side? Or can I have that with or without that? And if you can say yes, in your business that's so important, if you can say yes to just about anything that the customer's asking for.
We're not interested in no anymore. There's no reason to say no.
Yeah.
Unless it's unreasonable or it's not...
Or if you you, with all of your experience, you, I'm sure there may be things that a guest, a customer asks you for that you just know in your heart will not be good. And but there, the important thing is you immediately have the suggestion or the idea of the solution to right away, instead of, you're never saying no to the guest, instead you're saying, oh, how about this? You've got immediately, you've got something that you know will be better, that you know will make them happier, that will please them more, that the thing that they might, they think they want, that might not be.
But that is why you're successful. I was at a very fancy hotel in Florida 2 weeks ago, and we went to have lunch. And there's nobody serving the Sunday brunch. So where can we sit? Now you can sit inside at the lounge. I said, we'd love a hamburger. No, you can't order the hamburger, but you can only order from me. I said, this is a major hotel. Mm. I should be able to have whatever I want, wherever I want.
Right? Absolutely.
I mean, you're charging a fortune.
Yes.
So don't tell me what I can, what I can't have, and when I can have it, and then tell me what I need to pay
for it. I'll bring your hamburger to the restroom if you want.
Absolutely. You know,
you'll bring it from New York to Florida for him.
I always say to the team that work with me, you know, hashtag whatever it takes. Everyone who works with us has graduated from the university of whatever it takes.
Yeah. So question, and I get this question a lot, and I grapple with it. From a business perspective, can you actually scale with that degree of attention to detail and customization? I mean, you have a beautiful restaurant. It's a popular restaurant. It's a single location.
Yep.
You do have probably 100 people working for you, maybe more, but you do one event at a time, and you're all in when you do it. You're not a factory.
No, I'm not a factory, but when we do a lot of consulting in the hospitality space and the how I make you feel part of it, you have to scale it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about coming up with, first of all, the ethos for everyone to buy into.
The culture.
I think you need to have that culture, a very, very rich culture. You have to have a very clearly defined vision, mission, and guiding principles that everybody buys into. And without that, you can't build anything.
Yeah.
Right? And I think you once you've got all that built and all that together, you can start to create the type of experience that people will never forget about.
But then you still have to go back and reinforce it every day.
Single day. And you have to rehearse it all the time, and you have to have checks and balances. I do a thing, I have a protocol called the 3 5s. For whatever idea you have, you can apply the 3 5s to it. The 5 things we do before, the 5 things that are actually the delivery of it, and the 5 things after. How do we reset? How do we reprogram? Mm. And how do we learn from what happened and set ourselves up for the next time?
And say thank you.
And say thank you. And it's really easy to do because you're setting it up, you're getting it done, and you're setting it for the next one. And you're learning what didn't work the time before.
Yeah. And it's brilliant that you've created a formula.
Well, a case in example was when I was creative director for NetJets, we were dealing with flight attendants and we were dealing with pilots who thought that they were God. You had their life in your hands, in their hands. And they'd want to get onto the plane and make a left-hand turn and not worry what was happening behind them. So I figured you've got one chance enough to make a first impression. How can we get them to change the story? So the story believed if someone would walk into the airport at Aspen and say, who's flying to New York and put the hand up? That's not luxury. So my 3 5s were, we emailed you the picture of who you're picking up. Okay, you're picking up Ms. Brown at the airport. We see your picture.
I should be so lucky.
Two, he's got his business card in his left hand. His hat is on his head. His dark glasses are off. He's not chewing gum. The top button is done. Okay, at 10 feet, he breaks a smile and engages with you. At 5 feet, he puts out his hand and he shakes his hand, and then he makes his introduction. Those 5 things made a great first impression.
Yeah.
And I was able to scale that across 7,900 pilots.
Oh, you make a really good point. I mean, everything could be broken down to the smallest elements.
So then we get in there, can I help you to the plane? Once we're on the plane, the safety procedure, the catering, come back and check, can I get you something to drink? And then do the final wrap-up before you land.
Yeah.
And then when you land afterwards, what did we hear? What did we learn? Did he like this? Did he not like this? Go and speak to the ramp guy who took the luggage off and get as much information as you can. Take that back to owner services. Next time they speak, they've got more ammunition.
Well, when I introduced Colin earlier as a man who does everything, I didn't mention, although it should have been included in everything, that he's also a military operation commander. Very impressive. And that's after he's a Picasso of event mood boards.
That's a salute when you...
It's a very colorful life.
So for all the people who have been as wowed as I am by your genius, your vision, and your operational prowess, where can they find you and learn more about all your events?
ColinCowie.com. Uh-huh. And I'm always fun to follow on Instagram.
Especially, when that wedding happens.
Yes, which is at Colin Cowie and at Colin Cowie Lifestyle.
Okay, and Miss Georgette.
The Instagram is GeorgetteNY. And the website as well, georgetteny.com.
And this restaurant, which is one of my favorites here in the city, is on 60th.
60th between Madison and 5th.
So thank you both for carving out the time. You're busy, busy people and thank inspiring you. Us for the holidays.
Pleasure. Thank you for
Look
making us so welcome.
Forward to having you back on the show
thank
in
you.
The new year.
An honor thank to you. Be invited. Thank you.
Okay. You've been listening to Tastemakers on Sirius XM Stars. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in.